All right, we'll call case number 21-4055, Mitchell versus Roberts. Mr. Mason.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Walter Mason, counsel for Terry Mitchell, the appellant and plaintiff. I intend to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. 2 days ago, Utah State Representative Ken Ivory submitted House Joint Resolution 4 to the Rules Committee. That resolution proposes to amend the Utah Constitution to provide, quote, "the legislative power of the state includes the power to provide for the revival of a civil cause of action for child sexual abuse, as defined by statute, after expiration of the cause of action due to an applicable statute of limitations." The legislature is taking action on the remedy proposed by the Utah Supreme Court opinion in this matter. Now, no vote has yet been made on that bill. And if it passes in the House and Senate, the matter would be voted on by the people of Utah in the November election. But if this amendment passes, or a similar amendment, then Terry Mitchell should not have to face a dismissal with prejudice from the federal courts as a possible barrier to her bringing her claims against Roberts.
If you intend for us to rely on what you just read to us, I think you need to supplement your record.
I'll be happy to present a supplemental authority. The court can also take judicial notice of the legislative action, but
we'd like to see it before we search generally for things we should notice.
I'll do that today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And when the Utah legislature passed the revival statute, Utah Code Section 78B2308, they intended the plaintiffs, just like Terry Mitchell, would rely on it. The legislature did everything possible in that bill to make sure plaintiffs could rely on it. And that's exactly what Terry did. She relied on that statute. And there was nothing improper about Terry doing that.
So why does that matter? I mean, that she relied on it, a statute that was found to be unconstitutional.
Because
where's the reliance come in?
Because
to your legal theory.
Thank you, Your Honor. Because under Olander, we do look at the conduct of the plaintiff. And Roberts contends that plaintiff Terry Mitchell somehow acted unreasonably by filing a complaint pursuant to this statute. But that's not true at all. It was completely reasonable for her to dismiss her first complaint, which did not rely on the statute, and refile pursuant to the statute. There was just a very brief time period in between those. And that's why it comes in. When the matter went before the Utah Supreme Court, that court held the legislature lacked the power to revive time-barred claims. But the court also provided a remedy. The court made clear that the legislature could, in the future, revive time-barred claims if the Utah Constitution is amended. In other words, while Roberts had a, quote, vested right in his statute of limitations defense, it is not an absolute or unqualified defense.
Mr. Mason, may I ask you a question about the significance of the Utah Supreme Court decision and how it bears on the district court's analysis here? Your client sought certification, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so if comity is a consideration here under Olander, is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so does the fact that the district court is in receipt of an answer to a certified question that you posed bear directly on the importance of the district court's action here? I mean, didn't it really have to give special significance to the answer that it received to a certified question of state law?
Absolutely, it did. And the district court abused its discretion by misinterpreting that opinion. Roberts cites authorities saying that where a certified answer clearly dictates a result for the defendant, that's dispositive. Here, the Utah Supreme Court did clearly dictate a result for Roberts, and that's that he has a qualified defense. It's not absolute. You
In what way is it qualified? I mean, maybe I'm misreading the opinion, but the Utah Supreme Court seems to very carefully discern its own law, and it has a very clear understanding of a statute of limitations defense as almost like a vested property right. So in what way is it qualified? And specifically, in what way is it qualified in the language of the Utah Supreme Court opinion?
It's qualified because the Utah Supreme Court made clear there is a remedy and that the Constitution can be amended just as is happening with a bill right now.
And so you're hanging your hat on the, what is it, the last paragraph that says the terms of that charter, and that we're talking about the Constitution of the state, merit our respect unless and until they are amended or repealed?
And
that the language you're hanging your hat on?
Yes, that in part. And also the language.
So isn't that really what Judge Rossman is saying? This is a ruling by the Supreme Court, the highest court of the state, interpreting their constitution. And the district court here gave credence to that, which is totally expected and appropriate.
And Mitchell concedes that dismissal is appropriate pursuant to the Utah Supreme Court opinion. But to say that Roberts would be prejudiced under Utah law if Mitchell were allowed to revive her claim pursuant to a constitutional amendment, that's just an absolute clear error of law. Under Utah law, there would not be prejudice to Roberts if the Constitution is amended and Mitchell is permitted to bring her claims again against him. Under Utah law, there's no prejudice.
But there is prejudice, isn't there? Because he's now been joined twice in litigation over the issue. He has twice presented a valid statute of limitations of defense. You agree that in both cases, his limitations defense was valid, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so what he's facing under your scenario is another lawsuit. And I mean, I guess my question is where will he finally be prejudiced? I mean, what if the Utah legislature does amend the Constitution and the people approve it, and then somehow it's found that there was a procedural error with it, and he sued again and wins? I mean, at some point he has to win in a way that there is a dismissal with prejudice to the plaintiff, doesn't he?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is all contemplated within the Olander factors. We look at the effort and expense and preparation of trial. There's been none. Roberts submitted nothing. It's not even clear that he's ever paid for counsel.
Mr. Mason, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but maybe I'm misunderstanding your argument. I thought that your contention on appeal was that the district court had made a legal error under Olander, that it had essentially applied like a per se categorical rule in terms of how it understood the statute of limitations defense. Is that right? Or are you contending that the district court sort of just applied Olander and misbalanced the factors? I thought you were making a legal argument, a legal error argument.
It is a legal error argument first, that the district court misapplied Utah law and came to an erroneous conclusion that there was per se legal prejudice from the purported loss of a vested right to a statute of limitations defense. But the district court also didn't consider a number of equitable factors that weigh heavily in this case, including the realities recognized by the Utah legislature and the Utah Supreme Court that child sex abuse is a massive national problem, that Victims have often lost the ability to bring their claims due to no fault of their own, but because of unjust statutes of limitations, and that the perpetrators frequently bring pressure to bear on the victims to ensure their silence. And that's exactly what we alleged in the complaint in this matter, that that's what Roberts did. He used intimidation and coercion to keep her silent. That caused her to miss her statute of limitations. And what we proposed, the district court was required to do, was simply adopt a curative condition that Mitchell may only refile her claims if the Utah Constitution is amended. And in that scenario, Roberts loses nothing. And he receives fully everything that he is entitled to receive under the Utah Supreme Court opinion. He receives.
But if it could be concluded or should be concluded that he is entitled to a dismissal with prejudice, isn't he prejudiced to go the other way and say maybe sometime, someday, somewhere, you will have to face this allegation yet again? Isn't that prejudice?
But that's what's required under Utah law, under the Utah Supreme Court opinion. Under Olander, this court should consider all of the equities. And I think Olander is particularly instructive where it looked beyond just the immediate facts of the case. It looked at how the Hague Convention interacted with the case. It looked at how possible decisions would change interpretation of disputes under the Hague Convention. Here, if Roberts is given a dismissal with prejudice, we set up a conflict with state law. Under state law, under the revival statute, a dismissal after adjudication based on the statute of limitations is not to be considered a dismissal on the merits. In other words, under the revival statute, it's a defense if you've already had your claims adjudicated. Those claims aren't revived. But there's an exception to that, that if it was adjudicated on the statute of limitations, that is not to be considered an adjudication on the merits. And if this court rules that it should be a dismissal with prejudice, we're setting up a conflict between state and federal law. But by imposing the curative condition, which there's no dispute that a curative condition, or there could be no dispute. I mean, Roberts raises a disingenuous dispute that the curative condition is perfectly lined up with the Utah Supreme Court's opinion.
Mr. Mason, in terms of your curative condition contention, what is the limiting principle that you would advance here? In other words, this condition contemplates it's dependent on a change in the law in the future. How is that not inappropriate under the federal rules?
Let's contrast this case with Grover. In Grover, there was a certified question and there was a split decision. It was, 5-4 decision. And the district court said, well, the law might change in the future. We don't disagree with that, but this case is different. We had a unanimous opinion from the Utah Supreme Court saying that the kind of right that Roberts has is subject to being revived with the constitutional amendment. The district court was bound to follow that and can't contradict what the Utah Supreme Court said about state law. And the district court has an amazing tool with the curative conditions. If the Constitution is not amended, Roberts is entitled to his defense. And that's why we seek just that curative condition that she be permitted to refile if the Utah Constitution is amended. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Baldwin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dick Baldwin. I represent Mr. Roberts. I guess I'll start by addressing what appears to be the primary thrust of Mitchell's argument today, which is this reading of the Utah Supreme Court opinion, which I think is it's bold. The Supreme Court squarely held, and Mitchell doesn't dispute, that its opinion clearly dictated a result for Roberts here, meaning it resolved the issue in Roberts' favor that the Utah Constitution currently precludes Mitchell's claims against him. She has no legal basis to assert these claims under Utah law. And yet, based upon truisms that apply in every case, Mitchell has attempted to somehow convert that loss into a win, that the Supreme Court has said that it's true that this right, this particular vested right that this person has, could change if the Constitution changed. That's true of every single constitutional right. The Constitution provides the foundational rules for the legal framework that the legislature is able to apply. And obviously, any of those principles can change. They are, you know, these are constitutional provisions are ones that we have decided by society would dictate, you know, the basic structure of the legal system. And so it's a truism that applies in every single constitutional analysis, that analysis only applies so long as the Constitution remains unamended. If it's amended, this constitutional analysis would change. So there's nothing remarkable or notable or meaningful about the Utah Supreme Court's commentary about that point, particularly given that the Utah Constitution doesn't require the Utah Supreme Court's participation in any way for it to be amended. The amendment process in Utah is that both houses of the legislature are required to pass a proposed amendment by a two-thirds majority. And if that passes, it then goes to the voters in the next general election who must approve that language by a majority vote. The Supreme Court has no role in approving what is a permissible amendment or anything like that. And so its language forecasting or describing that basic reality of constitutional law is purely that. It's just commentary. It is not a holding, and it certainly doesn't bind the district court in any way.
Mr. Baldwin, does the Utah Supreme Court's emphasis on the substantial policy justifications for revival statutes in Utah, is that a factor that the district court in this case should have considered more emphatically, given that this was in a response to a certified question, and we know that district courts have to consider the plaintiff's equities under Olander?
No, you know, the district court did, its conclusion to its order says that it considered the equities facing both parties. So to the extent that there was an equity that the court found relevant arising from those policy judgments, the district court, the order says that the court considered those considerations. That said, I don't think that those policy justifications play any outsized role here, given the context of what happened in this case and the fairly unique nature of how these legislative, these policy preferences play into the procedural history here. So the fact that this may be a policy that the Supreme Court finds to be reasonable or moral or just, that may be true. That doesn't mean that it is that is somehow the constitutional protection against asserting a claim under this revival statute is somehow contingent. Instead, it clearly said that this is a vested right, notwithstanding the fact that there may be some justification for or a desire on the part of the state to be able to nonetheless overwhelm the other considerations of finality that go into a statute of limitations. So there are obviously any policy question is going to have two sides, and the acknowledgement by the Supreme Court that there are policy justifications in favor of reviving statutes of limitations or even doing away with statutes of limitations entirely in certain kinds of cases, there obviously are arguments to be made there and it could be found to be reasonable, but that doesn't mean that it overwhelms the legal relevance of a vested statute of limitations right. And that's particularly important here, given the way that this case has played out, where Mitchell does not contest in any way that a result was clearly dictated here for Roberts, that under current Utah law, both statutory and constitutional law, Mitchell has no legal right to assert these claims against Roberts any longer. That is a concrete and real prejudice. Mitchell's prejudice, on the other hand, entirely rests on hypothetical notions about that are premised on these policy judgments that are contained in the revival statute, but they remain just that. They are hypothetical interests.
As I understand the appellant's briefing, the point seemed to be, and perhaps I misread it, that the district court erred in its analysis, its Olander analysis, and went too far afield to look at statute of limitations and to look at a loss of a statute of limitations defense, which was valid, and I don't think it's disputed that it is not valid here, that the court looked at that as basically a bright line rule. If you lose your statute of limitations, that is for sure prejudice. Is that the error that's alleged here?
You know, I share a bit of confusion that Judge Rossman and now Judge Briscoe that you've hinted at. The argument today seems to have shifted a bit from what's in the briefs. I agree that that appears to be the thrust of the argument in the briefs, that there is some sort of legal error embedded in the way that the court applied.
And is that error?
No, it is not. So the nub of that argument is that there's a disagreement in the Fifth Circuit and the 11th Circuit. And I would agree that the 10th Circuit is very likely, in my opinion, to align with the 11th Circuit's view here. But the disagreement is that in the Fifth Circuit, where a defendant has a statute of limitations defense, that requires a district court to deny a Rule 41 motion. In the 11th Circuit, and in the, I think it's safe to say that the 10th Circuit would likely agree with this, the possibility that the defendant might be stripped of a statute of limitations defense is not a bar to a Rule 41 voluntary dismissal. But like it seems every other circuit in the country, as far as I can tell, that is nonetheless an appropriate factor for a district court to take into account when deciding whether the equities weigh in favor or against a dismissal without prejudice. And so the reason why I think that argument ultimately fails is that the district court didn't rely on that contested portion of the Fifth Circuit's test, which is that this is a per se rule. Instead, the district court here, over 8 pages of analysis, went over multiple factors. It laid out all of the articulated factors the 10th Circuit has described, said that many of those were neutral, some of them weighed in favor of dismissal without prejudice, and then it spent a decent amount of ink discussing the prejudice that would arise from the statute of limitations issue that's at the center of this case. And it decided, consistent with, again, I think every federal circuit in the country, that the possibility that Roberts would be deprived of a valid statute of limitations defense, which incidentally Mitchell agrees clearly dictates the results for Roberts here, was an appropriate consideration and would prejudice Roberts if he was stripped of that. And that, in this case, what's unique about this case is that unlike many other, the typical Rule 41 case that involves a statute of limitations, you have a defendant who has asserted or has a valid statute of limitations defense, and the plaintiff comes to the court, and the plaintiff asks under Rule 41 to be allowed to voluntarily dismiss their case without prejudice so that they can refile in another jurisdiction. And something that is unique in this case is that Mitchell does not assert that there is another jurisdiction where these claims could be refiled at the time of dismissal. And Mitchell has not provided a single case, a single court in the country who has ever decided to dismiss without prejudice a time-barred claim where there is no other jurisdiction where those claims could be filed. And this court shouldn't be the first to do that. And it doesn't need to reach that question again, because it seems that the core, the basic legal disagreement that the Fifth Circuit is having with the 11th Circuit is as to whether or not a defendant who comes to the court and says, look, I have a valid statute of limitations defense. The plaintiff comes in and says, well, I would like to dismiss without prejudice so that I can refile in another jurisdiction. It appears as if the Fifth Circuit's view on that is that it doesn't matter and that the district court is not allowed to grant the plaintiff's motion, that it cannot dismiss without prejudice as long as the defendant has a valid statute of limitations defense. That's not what the district court did here. The district court instead weighed that prejudice from the statute of limitations defense alongside the articulated factors. And then even after it considered that prejudice, it then went on to weigh the equities for both parties. And only after considering the equities facing both parties did it decide that the prejudice that Roberts would suffer by losing the vested right to the statute of limitations defense, that a dismissal without prejudice was not proper here. And so what appears to be the legal error that is asserted in the briefing, I think, fails ultimately because it describes a possible circuit split that is inapplicable to the court's analysis in this case. And I would also like to point out that there is another analytical pathway that I think clearly applies in this case and that this court could use to affirm. And that is the plaintiff should not be allowed to try to avoid an adverse decision on the merits. And there are two sort of distinct categories that I think this doctrine is implicated in this case. The first is sort of a more factual one, straightforward application of the normal test. And the other is a legal principle. But first, I want to take on the factual point, which is to remind the court that Roberts moved to dismiss this second lawsuit, the current lawsuit, shortly after the complaint was filed, 4 years before the Utah Supreme Court decided the certified question. That motion was fully briefed, and rather than deciding the motion to dismiss, Mitchell sought certification, and the court granted that request for certification. And in the certification order, the district court put Mitchell on notice that this certified question could very well decide the case. Its language was that the Supreme Court's opinion was central to the outcome of to the determination of this case,
which is usually a baseline reason for asking for a certified question.
Precisely, and it's important for the notion of the plaintiff here being well on notice that there was a risk of an adverse decision on the merits here, and that case, of course, as we all know, was certified at the Supreme Court, and the decision for the Supreme Court, as Mitchell concedes here today, clearly dictated a result for Roberts. And so, based upon the forecasting the district court had done, that order, as soon as the Supreme Court issued its opinion, had clearly dictated a result for Roberts here, and there was an imminent adverse decision on the merits that everybody could see coming. 4 days after the Supreme Court's opinion, Roberts moved to reopen his not yet decided but fully briefed and long pending motion to dismiss. And only after that, more than a week after that, did Mitchell finally move under Rule 41 for a voluntary dismissal without prejudice. That to me is a hallmark example of a plaintiff attempting to avoid an adverse decision on the merits. The other related way that the court could get there under this sort of framework is a principle that the 10th Circuit has suggested that it would agree with, that the 6th and 7th Circuits have articulated, which is that a dismissal without prejudice under Rule 41 is improper when the law clearly dictates a result for the defendant. And the 10th Circuit has cited that favorably in, I believe it was in the Phillips USA case. I may be getting that wrong, and it may be in Brown v. Judge Briscoe's opinion in Brown v. Bakke or Bake. I'm not sure how you say that. But the 10th Circuit...
Bakke,
okay. The 10th Circuit favorably quoted the 7th Circuit standard that Rule 41 dismissal is improper where the law clearly dictates a result for the defendant. And here, as we've heard today, Mitchell concedes that the law clearly dictated a result here. And so that's an alternative analytical pathway that the court could affirm here. And then let's see the lastly on the curative condition point, I'd like to point out that in Judge Briscoe's opinion in that Brown case, there was discussion of curative conditions that I think is particularly instructive here, where the court decided that curative conditions were reasonable or were appropriate because the plaintiff had proposed a reasonable solution and had offered significant practical concessions to make it work. Here, the concession's not reasonable. It is entirely an end run around the current state of constitutional law in Utah. And there are no concessions at all. As reflected by the questioning today, there's no limiting principle on the request for the curative condition here. I see I'm out of time, so if there are no further questions, I will submit. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Looks like we have 48 seconds for a rebuttal for you, Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Your Honor. Roberts's analysis is backwards. The court should normally grant dismissal without prejudice, but there is no prejudice here. The only consideration demonstrating any possible prejudice to Roberts is that he might be subject to another suit on the same set of facts, and that Olander, Brown v. Bakke have rejected that. This legal issue is unusual. None of the cases anywhere in the country have dealt with the issue of retroactive revival of time-barred claims. The district court was required to consider those unique circumstances. Roberts says the moral, reasonable, and just considerations by the legislature and the Utah Supreme Court don't matter. They absolutely do matter. We are to weigh the equities, and the equities of this unique situation of revival require dismissal without prejudice to Mitchell's ability to refile if the Utah Constitution is amended. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both of you for your great arguments today. They were very helpful. The case will be submitted and counsel are excused.